Don't you give up, don't you let away. I'm talking about forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give in.
Don't you give up, don't you dare give in. Jack Tuckner and Deborah Orell here with you in the most precarious times here on Women's Rights in the Workplace. Hope everybody is doing well today. Thank you for tuning in. How are you, Deborah Orell?
Terrific.
Great to hear. Well, we're very excited. We'll jump right in. We have a prominent and very wonderful and helpful guest today, Ruth Raisfeld, who is a mediator, an attorney, and a negotiator, and we'll have her on in just a few moments. I just wanted to start out, apropos of Ruth's visit with us today, and to talk a little bit about, both in terms of her area of expertise and what's sort of going on, a little bit about what's been going on in the world regarding things we've been talking about, women and equal pay. And it sort of reminded me when I was thinking about the show this morning. You know, it was just a couple of years ago during the election, Deb, you probably recall, when Rush Limbaugh said that he mocked the existence of this so-called Republican war on women by saying it's a myth because, quote, Republicans date women, they marry women, they have children with women, they take women to dinner, right? They take women to dinner, they buy women diamonds and open car doors for women. Right. Rush, you're too good. You're just too good. You know,
really?
I always thought he left off
what
one.
What did we do to deserve that?
You know, I mean, I think that one of the things that's missing that women probably these days both need and want is hat tipping. We haven't been sort of doffing our hats to women in a long time. And I know that it's a sign of respect. Forget about equal pay, but good day to you.
Exactly.
Tip of the hat to you, babe. So on the heels of Equal Pay Day that we spoke about at length on this show, it was just this past April 8th, Equal Pay Day, and the Senate Republicans, days after Equal Pay Day, unanimously blocking a vote on the Paycheck Fairness Act, saying no to equal pay for women once again. And did you see veteran conservative gadfly Phyllis Schlafly, Deb, last
yes.
week, the founder of the so-called quote-unquote
yes.
pro-family organization Eagle Forum? She claimed that providing women with equal pay for equal work would deter their chances of finding a suitable mate. Again, this is 2014. A lot of people apparently believe that because, she explained, since a woman prefers to marry a man who makes more money than she does, Schlafly argued in an article, I forgot where it was posted, I think it was in the Washington Post.
No, it was in the Christian Post.
Oh, that's right. It was in a Christian magazine.
I read the article and literally my jaw, I couldn't believe.
You were
I was waiting for it to say The Onion.
Right, exactly. Well,
literally.
It's not The Onion, and of course a lot of people agree with her. She argues that decreasing the gender pay gap would leave women unable to secure a husband. She's, of course, a longtime opponent of the Equal Rights Amendment for women, and she wrote, quote, another fact is the influence of hypergamy. That is a word, ladies and gentlemen. H-Y-P-E-R-G-A-M-E. G-A-M-Y. The influence of hypergamy, which means that women typically choose a mate, husband or boyfriend, who earns more than she does. Men don't have the same preference for a higher earning mate. While women prefer to have a higher earning partner, men generally prefer to be the higher earning partner in a relationship. This simple but profound difference between the sexes has a powerful consequence for the so-called pay gap. Suppose the pay gap, she goes on, between men and women were magically eliminated. If women earned what they're worth, if that happened, the simple arithmetic suggests that half of women would be unable to find what they regard or who they regard as a suitable mate. So the conservative activist also noted that women do not deserve equal pay, just in case you disagree.
Yeah,
they don't deserve equal pay because, quote, they work fewer hours per day, per week, per year, and place a much higher value on pleasant working conditions, a clean, comfortable, air-conditioned office with congenial coworkers, as opposed to men who like it down and dirty with a lot of hateful, miserable people around them. So anyway, Schlafly concluded that the best way to empower women is to, quote, is to improve job prospects for the men in their lives, even if that means increasing the so-called pay gap, and I have only one word to say to that, oy. And I was just wondering, you know, perhaps women wouldn't need to marry such high earners if they could simply command a better salary for themselves, which is, you know, also recently in the news, COO Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook, Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg, claimed in her recently released best-selling book, Lean In, and she devotes an entire chapter to this, that she says that most women simply don't bother negotiating their salary. And she cited at least one study at Carnegie Mellon University that found that 57% of male students negotiate, but only 7% of females try to negotiate for a higher offer. So that may be true. And if women, or if any of us, need a basic primer in negotiating, then aren't we the lucky ones today to have Ruth Raisfeld, Esquire, here on our show? Because Ruth is a lawyer and mediator and knows a lot about negotiating, especially when it comes to the workplace. And I hope Ruth will be offering us strategies that everyone can use to negotiate better, whether it's preparing for a job interview, resolving a workplace dispute, negotiating your compensation, or maybe even a problem you're having with a boss or a coworker. Ruth Raisfeld has over 30 years of experience as an employment relations lawyer, mediating, arbitrating, litigating, and counseling organizations and individuals regarding issues arising under employment relations and labor laws. She's knowledgeable regarding claims of wrongful termination, executive compensation disputes, all forms of employment discrimination, sexual harassment, breach of employment contract, and other disputes arising out of the employment relationship. She's widely acknowledged as a super lawyer in New York, one of the top 25 lawyers in Westchester, New York, and she's a charter member of the New York Academy of Mediators and Arbitrators. And perhaps most importantly, I personally know Ruth to be an outstandingly awesome and effective mediator, as she's successfully mediated numerous employment law cases for clients of our firm. Are you still there, Ruth? Welcome to our show.
Hi, Jack. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Hi, Ruth.
We are terrific. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm excited to join in on this very interesting discussion, which has finally reached the very heights of our
legal, media, and political
world.
Right at the intersection of commerce on all of our fronts, digital and otherwise. Well, we're very pleased to have you here. Sure, please do.
And Deborah, the most exciting thing that was in the newspaper this weekend was the announcement by Chelsea Clinton.
Yes.
That she's and her husband are about to have a baby. And the page and a half article devoted to Hillary Clinton as a grandmother and what the political repercussions of that will
be. Of course, very important.
And again, it's almost inconceivable that in today's day and age, this would still be such a monumental event that it warrants that much attention.
That it's a topic. Exactly.
It's just
was that a topic that just underscores that she'll be an old broad? Is that the idea?
We don't want her.
Yeah, they made the point that if she appears warm and cuddly as the grandma, how will she have the, Jack, what you would say, stones
to push the
button
right,
if that, God forbid, nuclear holocaust
right.
needs
she'll be
to occur.
She'll be crying. No big bullshit or blockos for her. I'm sure she'll be
in tears.
Exactly. Oh, boy. Well, there is still...
That's a perfect segue into...
And, of course, Hillary Clinton is... a tremendous role model as a female lawyer.
Yeah,
that's right.
And she's a graduate of Yale Law School and served on the Watergate Commission and did all kinds of very, very serious things before she got the unpaid job of being the first lady.
Right, Mrs. Clinton. Right.
Right. And of course we know how she was literally almost run out of town for introducing the most complex legislation that our nation has seen
since Francis
Perkins authored the Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security Acts when she was Secretary of Labor for Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
You're talking about when she had the audacity also to suggest and propose that everyone have health insurance or health care?
That's correct.
Uh-huh, right.
That's correct.
Well, is there a point in here, though, that has to do with gender differences? Is there some sexism kind of, you know, also baked into this cake?
Well, there is. And the thing that's so fascinating about it is that those of you who, like me, are students of labor law and labor relations law, and follow the women who have been at the cutting edge of all this, know that Frances Perkins, who pushed FDR to enact this all this protective labor legislation, because she literally came upon the street scene of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire.
No kidding, I did not know that.
Was subject to the same kind of attacks, that she was a socialist, that she was in favor of big government taking over the lives of ordinary Americans. In 1933, that the proponents of the health care law, like Catherine Sebelius, for example, were subject to very, very similar commentary.
Mm-hmm.
So history does repeat itself in that, as far as we've come, and again, this is the 50th anniversary of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, that some of these old stereotypes are very hard to die. And part of that is because even today, there still is an imbalance in the role models out there. We still have an imbalance in the Senate, for example, in terms of the number of women. We're getting there slowly with the Supreme Court. Of course, the lower courts have many more women. Mm-hmm. And talking about the legal profession, women have been at least half, if not more than half, of the law students in the last 30 years.
Right.
But they still haven't crept up in equal measure to the highest areas of earnings in the legal community.
We're partners.
But it's not even close, right? Again, when you just back
no.
to you and I, when we're in various law firms in New York City, as we do in our practice, when we're and what we need to do, and I'm sure you do when you look on, you know, the masthead, so to speak, or on the website, there are times where, I mean, there's literally, you could count on one hand in a big firm the number of female partners, right? We're not talking about 30% or 40% that's saying we're still not up
right.
there. We're talking about real small numbers, aren't
right.
we?
Right.
Single
and, of course, this is not different than corporate boards of directors or academia or in deans of medical schools. And, of course, what we're seeing now is the debate as to, you know, why is this? Why haven't women, and we're not talking about minorities of color or disabilities, but just women, just the gender differences. Why haven't women been able to make it into these, you know, rarefied halls of power? And there could be many factors. Obviously, your firm focuses on when discrimination is a factor or the factor.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we read about in studies suggest that women's socialization as daughters and mothers and sisters does not necessarily introduce them to opportunities where they can hone the skills that one needs to succeed outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
And even though women are supposedly better students and more studious and better prepared, they may engage in some self-defeating behavior, for one.
Well, such as?
Well, they are apologetic about asking for benefits for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They may not, as Sheryl Sandberg points out, they may not even attempt to negotiate a better deal for fear of jeopardizing their role or appearing too aggressive. I think the one factor that I've seen, even as a mediator, I noticed this when I was going from my training in mediation, is that the women, when we were doing role modeling, were very, very earnest about being well-liked.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would adopt behavior that wasn't quite as directive or forceful as a man in these mock mediations that we conducted. and we're, you know, sort of, I don't mean to tell you what to do, but,
right.
you know, where a man would just say, well, have you considered?
Right.
And it's not necessarily, a sex-based difference. Of course, there could be individual idiosyncrasies in that area, but the, you know, the controlled studies, like the one that you quoted earlier in the program, does nevertheless show that there are these gender-based differences.
But do they come? We may have once discussed this. You know, both of us having daughters that are of similar age when they were in. And I remember the time when we were looking into should we send our daughters to all girls high schools. That there were studies that we saw that at some point, and I think it really was about adolescence, that up until, let's say, the sixth or seventh grade, girls were just as willing, perhaps, to be competitive in school. And there came a point when adolescence kicks in, hormones kick in,
right.
with the notion of raising your hand aggressively to beat out a boy for that answer because I'm going to kick your ass. I've got this. I'm smarter than you. Will wreak havoc on their social life. Because,
right.
first of all, no boys will want to go with this woman, this assertive, smarty-pants bitch, right? That type of a thing. Is that how
right.
they're perceived?
Right.
So they stay quiet and demure.
And by the way, not only the men mm-hmm. or the boys in the class don't like a smarty-pants.
Right.
The girls don't.
Right.
So,
right.
so and this is being referred to a lot in the literature now, and, of course, like the whole mean girl syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So women have to really be very careful mm-hmm. in how they present themselves with people in authority or people who have something they want. And mm-hmm. a lot of the writers are saying that this explains some of the gender gap.
Well, but let me ask you this from Lean In. You know, there was an excerpt. Deborah Grunfeld, a professor of leadership and organizational behavior at Stanford, apparently says in the book, I'm reading a quote, our entrenched cultural ideas associate men with leadership qualities and women with nurturing qualities and put women in a double bind, unquote. Because female negotiators are going against cultural gender norms, if you're negotiating for yourself or for another, people may view this female as aggressive and demanding and as a negative trait versus men where these traits are seen as positive leadership attributes. And to combat this, Sandberg offers a pragmatic approach to negotiate salary, for instance, the salary that you deserve to earn what you're worth, without being perceived as self-serving. She says that women should start off in a negotiation explaining that women often get paid less than men so that they're going to negotiate rather than just accept this original first offer that they're being, you know, that's being made. By pointing to the gender pay disparity specifically, you're making the statement that you're not just out for yourself, but also important is raising general awareness for all women. But it sounds a little bit, will that work, you know, in the breach? Like, will that work? What's your feeling about that?
Jack, mm-hmm. if your client, who you were advising, and of course this is a radio show, so it's not actual legal advice,
right.
were a great-looking, very wealthy, Harvard-educated young woman mm-hmm. who had already worked for Larry Summers,
right.
then maybe you would tell her, take a shot at that, right? That's why Sheryl Sandberg's advice
right,
is
right.
so bold. It
right.
comes from such a position of strength.
That
she already has. And by the way, as I said earlier, one of the reasons that women and increasingly men are reluctant to put themselves out there in the way that Sheryl Sandberg is suggesting is that they'd rather have a job
right.
than no job.
Right.
So Sheryl Sandberg, who's married to one of the
right.
wealthiest dot-com
right.
executives, and she herself, who you can just imagine what her personal net worth is,
right.
it's very easy for her to recommend to people who have the wherewithal to buy her book or
right.
to listen to her TED Talk
right.
to take
right.
this kind of a position.
Right.
But the ordinary subway riding public who you and I see and who Deborah fields numerous telephone calls from in
mm-hmm.
seeking
mm-hmm.
The advice of your firm, they don't have the power. They're not coming from a power base of Sheryl Sandberg to make such an audacious request certainly in an initial interview. But there are things that the typical wage earning woman can do and should do, and obviously this advice holds true for men as well, which is don't negotiate from a gut emotional place. Any negotiation should be one that you prepare for. You need to remember that practically everything you do is a negotiation, whether you're preparing for an interview or looking to get assigned to a different project or letting human resources know that you have a coworker that's bothering you or a boss that's giving you a hard time. You know, we all tend to react emotionally, even those of us who are lawyers and mediators for years and years. We sometimes shoot from the hip,
right?
And go with our gut, and we all really need to learn to pause and prepare.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my message to someone who is thinking about standing up for oneself in one of these issues.
Okay, so what will that entail? So first of all, so don't just go in and say, I'm really upset because I haven't had a raise in 2 years, and I really think I deserve one, and, you know, where it's not thought out. That's the underlying feeling, is I'm not being paid commensurately with the value I add to this company, right? And I'm getting kind of resentful about it. So what would you suggest? And if men perhaps are a little bit more acculturated, or sort of, you know, as part of whether it's their own upbringing, but just, you know, culturally, men to sit down in a supervisor or boss's office and say, listen, I'm here to ask for a raise. I've got 3 kids. You know what I've done. I mean, I don't know that it's any easier for men, but men just seem to feel that they need to. They won't advance unless they declare for themselves. Is there some distinction just in terms of now talking to what your experience, what women perhaps do less, you know, facilely as men?
Yeah, easily? I think that this advice holds true for both, but we're focusing it on this show certainly on how women can improve their standing in the workplace. And given that women are sometimes received differently than men, they should prepare themselves for that possibility. Of course, they could also be negotiating with a female boss.
Okay.
And the female boss might be just as riddled with stereotypical assumptions as a male boss.
Right.
So in negotiating, in preparing to negotiate with any boss in advance, one should literally take out a piece of paper and say to themselves, you know, what is my goal? What do I hope to achieve? If I were my boss, what would I want to hear in support of my goal? Okay. What have I done this year or the last 2 years that went above and beyond what my so-called job description might have required me to do?
Okay.
So it's important for people to sort of keep track of their wins.
Right.
If there was a loss or some project that didn't go well, you should be prepared to address that when the supervisor comes back and says, well, you know, you really screwed up on, you know, such and such a project. You should be prepared to either, you know, as they say, stand up and be a man and take responsibility, or have an explanation of how you came back from that defeat and did even more. But
okay.
But as you say, Jack, a lot in I've heard you say it, you know, what is the value added?
Right.
What value add did you bring to this company? People have said to me that you can only negotiate effectively when you can walk away. And so one of the things that is very helpful for people when they're trying to negotiate for themselves is what could I make if someone else offered me this money? What could I make at another firm in this same job category? And a lot of that information is available now on the Internet. You can put in, you know, senior marketer for you know, a Fortune 5000 company or Fortune 1000, whatever, you know. So first you have to really know your market. And when you bring information in support of your request or your negotiating position, it helps to inform the other side and make it harder for them to say no.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I was just sort of thinking while we were talking about this, and maybe there's a way to kind of make a distinction for those who still will go in and want and wish to declare for themselves, because otherwise they may be, you know, sort of just passed over and be in the position of, you know, they will never, that their employer will never value them if they don't declare for themselves, will never give them a raise, will never perhaps do anything to increase their reach or their ability to continue to add value to the company or to expand unless they sit down and say and sort of demand it. But we're also, you can't separate this from the culture we're in right now, right? We're looking at when you and I started out, it was a vastly different sort of world market. It is slim pickings out there, no?
Right.
So when you have that issue of, you know, we have 100,000 factories closing in the last 15 years and now opening, you know, in other parts of the world, formerly our jobs, and it's difficult out there. Does that mean that, you know, from your perspective, it doesn't mean that we're all just grateful for what we have and we're saying we're thankful for this minimum wage job and we keep our head down and don't ask for anything for fear of being fired, although I think that informs, right, a lot of people's concerns.
Sure. Yeah.
So well, we're not Sheryl Sandberg and we're not Arianna Huffington with a new book out to how to be rich, and maybe
right.
One of the things should be marry a billionaire and, as Deborah said, and then divorce him. That would be the first thing that we should all do. But beside that, is there, you know, so in this world as we find it right now, do you have what is, you know, still as it exists? And I am more interested, although it's for everybody, but do you find that in your work, and I know every time that you and I, you know, work together in a mediation, there are almost always women that you see when, you know, is there a gender-specific challenge that women more often than not face? I know there's wide variances, but just because of, you know, who they are as women in the workplace, that if you had one thing or three things to say to women, things that you do, because I could say what you do, you model that very behavior. And I think
right.
You probably had to learn that, right?
I did. And I studied it both by attending classes and workshops on the air, but also by reading.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the free newspapers that you get in the subway these days, AM, PM,
right.
Metro,
right.
They almost always have a column on, you know, how can I do better at work? But, you know, let's take the... you're really thinking about a couple of things. When I said at the beginning, what is your goal? If your goal is to make more money, and mm-hmm. you are in a sort of controlled compensation
mm-hmm.
Type of job, maybe it's a good thing to show that you want to be promoted. You want to get to the next step. You're thankful for having this hourly position. But you want to know what you can do
okay.
to be considered for a promotion down the road.
Okay.
What do I need to do to improve myself?
Got it.
Because that shows initiative,
mm-hmm.
and it shows you care about the company and not just thinking about yourself.
Right. And you're asking the powers that be.
And you're asking, not telling.
Right, okay.
So that's number one. So number two,
right.
you know, are you, if you don't think you can get more money, are you looking for more flexibility?
Okay.
Now, a lot of women, flexibility is really what they're looking for, because they need to know that they're going to be able to go to a school conference, or they need to
for
know
their
that
kids,
they're gonna,
you mean?
Yeah, or they need to know that they're going to be able to care for a sick parent. I understand that I can't make more money, but you think there's any way that I could work out a better schedule?
Right, but why does that fall on the female among us?
Well, it as I said, it could be equally applicable, but it tends to be an issue that women are more concerned about. Increasingly, however,
mm-hmm.
Men are as well. Either just because they want to have an equal role in dealing with you know, sort of soft issues like the family, but because they may be single parents,
right.
They may be in a homosexual marriage, and they both have child care responsibilities or parental responsibilities. So, but it's the idea that if a woman asks for flexibility, it's usually a switch goes off. You know, oh, this is because you have children.
Right.
If a man asks for it, I think they are more likely to be approached as, oh, aren't you a sensitive new age guy?
Right. It's even
and
worse.
And it might be frowned upon in their career.
Right.
So I think it's becoming increasingly, you know, difficult to just say that this is a woman's issue or a man's issue, except to the extent that the data support it. But again, so it's the way you frame the request, and the thing that I find, and I think again it's true for men, but as a woman I'll speak. When I prepare for negotiation or mediation, I literally like get myself psyched. And truly enough, there's actual data on this, that there's actual physical poses that you can strike that make you feel more empowered, which, uh-huh. you know, standing up straight, putting your hands on your hips, that these things make you feel a little bit more self-confident, that helps you before you enter into the room or the meeting. You know, you should try to compose yourself and, you know, get psyched. You know,
okay.
you think about athletes on the field before they head into the game. They put their hands together and, you know, do some sort of a cheer.
Right.
That's to get them psyched. It gets their energy going. It's
mindset.
Well, it's a mindset.
So, but they do a power move, but you're not suggesting that, you know, you bang your head against the wall and come in there like all, like you're, you know, coming onto the, at halftime on the football field. So it's an inner confidence that, you know, being, you're not going to be doing massive power moves probably before you go in there and come in all schwitzy, right?
But I mean, you could even read, this is called priming.
Right.
It's an actual neuroscience concept.
Okay.
That when you prime yourself to succeed, when you prime yourself to be strong, when you prime yourself to be confident, you actually become more confident.
And how do you what are suggestions on how one primes oneself?
Well, you know, you could literally, you see people reading the Bible on the subway.
Right.
You could literally read a self-help book. You
okay.
could literally read one of Oprah's books.
Okay.
You could, you know, these are not things that are inaccessible to the
right.
ordinary person. You don't have to read a Harvard Business Review article.
Right.
You know, I have a book on my shelf which I love called Pitch Like a Girl by Rona Lichtenberg, How a Woman Can Be Herself and Still Succeed.
Okay.
There's tons of this stuff out there. And it can help you. But
so you can be confident and psyched and primed and still be a girl. So
absolutely.
You can pitch like a girl. So you can, and again, I love that analogy. So you could throw that ball the way that we all say, like the way guys are, you're throwing with your weak arm, and you look like a girl who's never thrown before. But you do it with such a, you know, joie de vivre and a confidence and an inner centeredness that it's just as effective, because you are a woman, right?
Right.
You can't be a man, and you're not supposed to be.
Well, that's one of the, you know, I think that's one of the mistakes that people, young people in particular, make, is that they think they have to act like a man, or the way the boss acts in order to succeed. And you do see that. You see how people who work together start to sort of sound like each other. And,
right.
You know, I think you need to be yourself, but you need to be your best self.
Okay.
Which leads me, Jack, to a plug for, the idea that you have to rehearse this stuff, and sometimes it's best to rehearse with someone who is not emotionally involved, like a lawyer,
right.
or a financial planner, or an accountant,
okay.
or just a good friend who sees things that you don't see about yourself, and who will give you honest feedback. You know, try it out on somebody first and get advice. But the main thing is not to wing it.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Fascinating. And how does one avoid, though, when you talked about women and flexibility, if a woman is seeking, let's say, that flexibility that has to do with things that are still denominated as the female gendered things, like you got to be home for the babysitter, and if she calls in sick, or your kid's got is ill, it's the woman who's going to take off. It's how do you avoid getting mommy tracked? How do you avoid asking for this and not then become, you know, again, the diminished state girl who's like, you know, it's like pick a lane, right? That's where they
right.
have babies.
Well,
you're going to work for us.
I've always followed the very simple commandment, which is make your boss look good. So in the work that you do, make yourself indispensable so that they'll wait for you to come back from a parent-teacher conference, or they understand that you're not available on Fridays.
Right.
Just show that the work that you do in the time that you allot to it is so good and so efficient and so valuable that you get respect for trying to balance the work, you know, trying to succeed in the work-life balance instead of it being an inhibitor. But let's face it, the workplace itself has changed, but work has only gotten more expansive.
In what do you mean?
In what regard? Well, workplaces are, increasingly diverse and increasingly flexible, and some people work from home. But work is now 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That has happened because of the internet and because of globalization and because of the constant goal of employers to make more than they made last year, and that's the goal of employees too. So we have this very upwardly mobile society, and if you're not available to take a phone call at 10 p.m., years gone by, Jack and Deborah, I'm sure you don't have any recollection of a parent working every night on phone calls or Skype or whatever, which it was unheard of.
But there were boundaries.
There were boundaries. There was an expectation that people were going to get home in time for dinner.
Right.
Now it's a demerit if you think you can leave the office.
Well, you can leave the office, but there are, it's the boundary thing.
I'm reachable. I'm reachable.
Yeah.
Right. Reachable.
So nobody wants to be. You get a business card today and it has the person's email, cell phone. Twitter.
Right.
Blah blah blah. It's like 8 million ways of reaching this person. They're so important.
Yeah.
So that's why I say work has expanded.
Yeah.
The workplace is working to be more sensitive to individual needs. But it's increasingly difficult because of the 24/7 expectation.
But you're in your own case, you did find it, did you not? In order to have that so-called work-life balance, ultimately you did need to kind of forge it yourself, right? Because you
my view was as much as organizations talk the talk, they have trouble walking the walk, because after all they are not social welfare organizations,
right.
They are economic engines, and they can try to accommodate the needs for flexibility.
I know, but Ruth, if we were like every other industrialized nation on the planet, for instance, with issues of family leave, with issues of, right, we would have 6-month paid leaves or a year like they do in the Netherlands, and we would not make this an issue on, have only women figure out how to juggle this. We would sort of work it into the fabric of these are our kids, right?
Right.
These are our family units,
right.
And how do we
But we're
it?
Not. We're the United States,
right.
And
right.
We pretend to be the greatest nation and the most successful economic engine in the world. And if you've ever been to any of these other places, you might say, all right, it's easy for the Netherlands because you could literally walk from one end of the Netherlands to the other in a couple of days. You can't do that. We sort of have a bigger.
Well,
pie.
It's also every other of the 34 OECD countries, DC, OECD countries, all the other, the industrialized civilized nations, and all of them, all of Europe, they all have paid maternity leaves, right? I mean, we're in the bottom with Swaziland. you know, in Papua New Guinea.
Exactly.
That's it.
Those two.
That's it. So,
yeah.
You know, it's just that I think we also make it more difficult and we don't allow, because that's why you
and
had.
And it's the parent penalty that well, because, women experience.
Because, you know, we have the, it's just a very, very complex, I'm not justifying it,
right.
But it's just a very, very complex society, and we have this system of checks and balances that our forefathers, not foremothers, but our forefathers came up with, and it does sort of slow things down.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you've spoken about it a lot. Social change is very hard to effectuate.
Mm-hmm.
Through legislation,
right?
But that's the system that we have. But again, it does come back to why we're seeing so many people just sort of leaving the traditional corporate world,
right,
and starting their own businesses.
Right, but you know, not so easy. And that was why, again, perhaps why the Affordable Care Act was such an important first step, because it would potentially allow people to leave and have health insurance and start something up that's entrepreneurial,
right,
and they might not be such wage slaves. You know, I wanted to ask it. I just want to say, because I didn't give it, if anyone wants to ask Ruth a question, please call us at 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888, and we'll get you right on the line with Ruth. Here's a question it may seem trite, but I don't actually think so. I've never asked you this or even mentioned it, but
Jack, that was very female of you.
Thank you. Well, you know, I am a girly man, as I understand. But I you know, your attire, I think if I were a woman, I would dress like you. You command. I mean, you are an attractive human being, and you dress beautifully. But in my recollection of seeing you, always, you know, in professional business settings, you never wear dresses, and you do never wear skirts.
You want me to tell you why?
Yeah, I think it works. There's something about showing legs.
It's a very practical thing. And we haven't spoken about it yet, but we're about to get to the subject of mediation.
Okay.
And when I get up to go to work in the morning, I don't know if I'm going to be there for 4 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours, or 16 hours.
Right.
And any man who has ever worn pantyhose
right,
and heels can tell you that at about the fifth or sixth hour, you're starting to feel very uncomfortable.
Well, that would be enough. That's enough of an answer right there. No, but I mean, that's enough of an answer. Why should I be uncomfortable? And I get that, although I never thought of that.
Well,
no,
that's really it. But why should I be uncomfortable? No. I wear dresses for all kinds of social occasions, and in fact, if I have to go into the city for dinner on an event or for dinner, I'll often choose to wear a dress because I don't wear dresses when I have to say it has a lot to do with comfort, and that's why you see Hillary Clinton almost always in. The woman gets on an airplane and flies 16 hours.
But that's enough of a reason right there. If you just say, again, a man would say, I'm not going to wear, you know, what are they, a kilt. If I'm uncomfortable, I'm going to wear, and that's why wearing 6-inch heels, which will cripple you and are clearly not comfortable, and you're not wearing probably for yourself, you'd wear, and that's another thing that I notice you wear.
Yeah, I feel really bad that a lot of young female associates think that they have to wear very high heels.
But don't they think that for a reason? Isn't it probably if they dress like you, while you come off, while you're clearly feminine?
Well, when I was a young attorney, I used to wear high heels too. Let's be honest.
Well,
I'm 58 years old. I'm going to be 58 years old. But I have to say that there has been, and Jack, you also always dress
nicely. I wore heels.
And this is not a mutual admiration society, but this is a sort of old-fashioned belief that when you are, you know, an attorney and you earn, you want to earn the respect as well as the financial, as you would say, emoluments that go along with a career like that, that you should dress the part. I have to tell you that I don't think that this dress down, casual dress approach to the workplace has been the right way to go.
Right.
I don't think that people are as alert and careful and as error-free when they're casually dressed. But the same argument applies. If a guy is going to be sitting at his desk for God knows how many days in a row working on a brief or staring into the computer, having to wear a suit and a tie is a comfort issue. So there's arguments on both sides. But I don't wear pants or pantsuits to command respect. I just think that a proper business attire helps get the kind of respect and get you want people to listen to you.
So you don't think, I appreciate the distinction between wearing, you know, that we are dressed, we try to take care and dress beautifully because it's sort of our uniform, and I agree, I'm wearing a suit and a shirt and a tie, and I like to dress up for the work that I do. I'm saying that what I think and why I don't think it's that when you talked about power moves or get, because when you come across as a professional woman, as, and again, without losing any of your femininity or your femaleness, but you have a certain gravitas, a certain strength. You stand there and you're sort of toe to toe with the rest of us, and you don't need to ever, it seems to me, resort to any of the little, you know, and some of us, and you might have done it when you were young and up at the bench with a judge, and you might have fallen into a certain, you know, a certain sort of conditioned response, perhaps, that you may have done out of nervousness and what have you. But is the, when you wear a suit, as I see you wear, because I think it's perhaps important that when you come off looking sort of strong, and it's almost, it's not gender neutral, but again, you're not dressing up and saying, look, here are my legs and my pantyhose and my pumps that go with it. I'm a girl lawyer. You are an attorney, and you are dressed the way I'm dressed, in an expensive suit and an expensive shirt and beautiful shoes. But
I just think people take you more seriously.
Okay.
It's really a question, you know, as the mediator.
Okay.
I'm there because both sides need help getting to a resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to at least appear to be the person who is capable of giving that help. So if you dress the part and you show that you're, There was an old saying from one of my favorite plays of all time, Fiddler on the Roof. Mm-hmm. When you're rich, they think you really know.
Right.
So when you come in and you look like you're successful,
like Shelley Adelson, we think he knows. He doesn't know.
You know,
anything, yeah.
when you look like you're successful,
yeah.
People think you're smart. People think, ooh, you know what? This person must really know. We
right.
ought to listen to her.
Right.
So that has a lot to do with it. That's why you see on Wall Street the traders wear these big fat watches.
Yeah, why do they do that?
Because it makes them look successful. If they can afford a watch like that, they must know what they're talking about. It's
okay.
A very subtle
right.
cue. It's a very subtle cue that you look the part. Now there are people who like to, you know, they're fabulously wealthy people. You know, take Warren Buffett, for example. He probably doesn't show up in a $10,000 custom suit.
Right.
He probably
he doesn't need to.
Yeah, well, but there's like a, you know, a bell curve
right,
on this.
Right. He can wear whatever schmata
yeah,
thing
he wants to wear.
So.
Now, you know, you never see Arianna Huffington or Tina Brown looking like, well, as long
right.
as we're on the subject.
They're
subject.
Not in a schmata.
Right.
They're not in a schmata, and they don't look schlumpy.
Right, right.
And if you ever go watch Sheryl Sandberg's TED Talk, she's probably wearing a $3,000 black dress that fits her like a glove.
Right.
She's not showing up with a $9.99 dress from the Gap.
Right. All right. So you're not buying into, though, because I think I would say this, and I would tell my daughters this, and again, if I could, that I think that I would, because you're saying you go to, you know, I guess there are, I suppose socially, there are times you're comfortable in a beautiful dress to, I don't know, you know, dress from a skirt to a gown, or when you would wear that.
Right.
But I'm buying it. But if when you went to court as an attorney, would you wear a beautiful tailored pantsuit, or did you feel obligated to somehow come swishing in there wearing a skirt or a dress?
No.
You wore pantsuits as well?
Not in my time. You know what? I always wore, if I wore a skirt, I invariably wore a skirt and a jacket
right.
to court.
Okay, got it. All right.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel more comfortable in separates.
Right.
And by the way, early in my career, I worked at a law firm that represented a lot of dress designers and manufacturers. So I always had access to the finest clothing, and I felt that you should dress like your clients if you have.
Oh, so you did, and you were probably an off the rack perfect size because you're the same size now, right? You were small, you fit into those perfect.
Yeah. Jack, are you just going to drive people to my website?
I'm going to drive with you to see what does she look like. She's a perfect four.
But before you hand the show over to Carrie Harrison at 6 o'clock, we really want to talk about this phenomenon called mediation.
Yes, please.
Yes.
So, for the hordes of people who are out there listening to this, mediation is a term that you're seeing even more and more now in foreign affairs. It's a third party who is asked by both sides to help settle a dispute, and John Kerry was attempting to mediate the dispute between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and now he's attempting to mediate the dispute between the Ukrainians and the Russians, and he's not exactly a mediator because he is also an advocate for the United States' point of view, but it's the idea of a third party who helps both sides negotiate with each other.
Okay, that's a mediator. Explain to how is a mediator different from an arbitrator?
An arbitrator is selected by an agreement by both sides to abide by the arbitrator's decision of who's right and who's wrong.
So the arbitrator is more like a judge.
The arbitrator is more like a judge. The mediator is disinterested in what the actual result is so long as there is a resolution.
Okay. So the mediator...
And doesn't make up the minds of the parties themselves. They help the parties...
Help the parties.
...come to a decision as to whether and how to resolve a difference of opinion between the two sides.
Okay, and when would this come to pass, or when does this happen as a practical matter in domestically with more what our listeners might find themselves in a situation where they would need you?
Right. Well, I 99% of the time I'm hired by lawyers who have decided that there's a threatened litigation or pending litigation, an actual lawsuit, where the lawyers for the parties think that it's appropriate to try to resolve the case, the dispute, before going deeper into the judicial system. And so the lawyers agree on behalf of their clients to pursue mediation. And,
why is that a good idea for both sides, usually?
Yeah.
Why?
Now, obviously, some attorneys, your firm is one of them, likes to try to pursue mediation very early in the dispute to avoid the time and expense and the heartache that your clients will experience if they are relegated to the judicial system, which takes a long time and is very expensive, and there's a lot of ups and there's downs, and there's sort of a lack of control. It's just this very long waiting game, as well as just the laborious task of making your voice heard and understood, which is subject to all these arcane rules. But in mediation, there really are no rules. There's just an attempt to have a civilized conversation that's expedited and sort of nudged along by the third party neutral, who's the mediator. And they don't take one side or the other. They may carry negotiating communications back and forth so that the parties don't have to look at each other when they're trying to come up with what their next move is.
Mm-hmm. So,
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just we have, and I'm told, 3 minutes left. So let me say this, because you know that I'm a huge fan of mediation, a big believer and an advocate for the process, because I always say to our clients who sometimes, some of them are very, very hurt, you know, want some measure of justice and are prepared to go and spend 4 or 5 years in pitched battle without knowing, you know, what will happen, all the uncertainties of litigation. And when I say to them, why don't we sit down? It'll be sort of like your swift day in court, so to speak, slash group therapy, in the sense that you will have time. We will be there. Ruth Raisfeld is the mediator and she's the neutral, but you will have an opportunity to be heard without interruption, without cross-examination, without a script, to talk, to cry, to show them how betrayed and hurt you were and are, perhaps, still. And they will get a chance to speak too. And we're all going to be able to sort of vent and talk about our position factually and legally. And then we're going to split up. And then Ruth is going to spend the better part of a long, long day going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, facilitating and using her well-developed interpersonal skills for both sides, her rapport, to sort of try to bring us closer together so that, you know what, we can resolve this. Instead of 5 years and somebody wins and somebody loses, or everybody loses in certain ways, that, you know, you're able to walk out feeling, if not completely vindicated, feeling heard, seen, and you have a resolution. And typically, of course, from our client's perspective, a certain amount of U.S. currency, you know, a sob for their wounds, and they're able to then just separate and ride off into the sunset. And I mean, and so from my perspective, the process itself, I sometimes use the term holistic, in that it deals with many of the even underlying issues that would never come out in litigation. I mean, how do you just finally, maybe to just sum up in the last couple of minutes,
One minute.
So just the last minute is yours, Ruth, and thank you for being here, but to talk about why mediation is something that is almost always a preferable end resolution to a case that is in controversy in court.
Time, money, and aggravation.
Time,
so
money.
Now you got another 20 seconds, Jackie.
You're the best, Ruth.
Well, thank you. You know, so your website again just give it to our listeners.
www.rdradr.com. I just encourage more people out there to stand up for themselves and to prepare. Mm-hmm. And they got to believe.
Got to believe, okay? And don't dare give up hope. How's that?
Don't give up hope. Keep hope alive.
Thank you very much for inviting me to share my remarks. You're quite. Thank you very much for being with us.
Bye bye.
We'll see you soon. Bye bye now. And next week, Deborah, we have with us. We have a guest next week.
Yes, Dove Kesselman.
Next week is a labor and employment defense attorney, Dove Kesselman, who's going to tell us what it's like from the other side, representing companies that are being sued for discrimination and harassment.
Maybe what they can do to avoid that.
And maybe what they can do to avoid being sued. We're the ones who sue them, and Dove represents the companies who are sued. So that should be an interesting and fascinating conversation. Until then, have a strong and powerful week. Jack Tuckner, Deborah Orell from Tuckner, Sipser, Weinstock, and Sipser, the Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocates, telling you to stay strong. And remember, no matter what the situation is at work, remember one thing: do not quit. Nicely done. Enjoy the bumper music, and we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye now.